Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jonathan Lethem, whose latest novel is Chronic City. Earlier novels include You Don't Love Me Yet, Fortress of Solitude, Motherless Brooklyn. There are 12 books in all.
8 novels, 2 story collections, an essay collection, and then a couple of what a musician would call EP releases, kind of a novella and a couple of things I edited. Depending on how you want to count, I'm between 10 and 14 books, I guess.
Chronic City takes us into the Upper West Side of Manhattan, but as I was reading the book, and particularly when I got to the end, I realized that this is not really our Manhattan. It's somewhere between our Manhattan and a cyberized or semi-fictional version of Manhattan, kind of a Second Life version of Manhattan. It seems like that was conscious.
Yeah, I wanted to try to tease into view in this book a suspicion I've had all my life about Manhattan, that it's a combination of a real place and a kind of virtual reality. And I felt that about it in a way before the term virtual reality was available. But there's something about this island that's as much the product of fantasy and projection and people's aspirations. It's an imaginary place that real people live in. You know, you have this image of it as a kind of solipsistic snow globe of a place. Even the famous New Yorker cover, Saul Steinberg's picture of 10th Avenue and 11th Avenue and then 12th, the Hudson River and China as a distant flare in the background. So I wanted to try to write about the conflation of this place, the way it conflates the imaginary life and the real life.
I grew up in New York, as did you, but you grew up in Manhattan, right?
My parents were living in an illegal sublet in what is now Soho when I was born, and then I ended up in Brooklyn, and I came of age, you know, 3 subway stops from Manhattan. So it was there, but it wasn't quite mine. When you're from the outer boroughs, you have the same relationship to Manhattan that the whole world does. It's a fixation and a place to aspire to. Yet I could also go and, you know, buy a subway token and, you know, walk around Greenwich Village with a slice of pizza. It didn't mean you'd crack the code. Manhattan still had mysteries. It was a kind of facade that you wondered what was behind the screen, you know. But it was thrilling that you could also, you know, kind of try to make it your own.
What do you think is the difference between that vision and, say, as you did years ago, living in the East Bay and traveling to San Francisco?
It's funny. When I first came out to the Bay Area, I projected the New York schema on this place. I decided, you know, Berkeley was Brooklyn, Oakland was Queens, and San Francisco functioned as Manhattan. And there are ways in which that's pretty accurate. I mean, it's much easier to get a Brooklynite to go to a party in Manhattan than the reverse, and it's much easier. The East Bay travels to parties in San Francisco, but San Francisco doesn't condescend to cross the other way.
Fortress of Solitude and Motherless Brooklyn, they're set in Brooklyn. Do you think that Brooklyn feels in a way more real than Manhattan then?
I think it does to me anyway, and I think that I'm not completely alone or crazy in the suspicion that Manhattan is a place made crazy by its success. The fact that Brooklyn kind of falls short a lot. It's always being renovated, it's always being rehabilitated, but those projects kind of fail. They sit around half-finished. It keeps Brooklyn sort of real and humble, that it's meant to be part of this glamorous city, but it's kind of the lump in the half of it.
When I was growing up, you know, if you lived in Queens, you never traveled to Brooklyn. There was never any reason. Now, Brooklyn, sometimes parts of Brooklyn, Park Slope, Carroll Gardens, other areas, feel almost like Greenwich Village East.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a destination and very desirable precinct. And I guess you could say those parts of Brooklyn are kind of Manhattanized. But there's a lot else. There's a lot of Brooklyn that's still out in the cold. I mean, if you ever drive straight down Atlantic Avenue to go to the airport instead of using the Belt Parkway, it's almost impossible to fathom how much of Brooklyn is still kind of a mad ruin of poverty and ethnic enclaves, and it's still a place that has yet to join the party.
The story of Chronic City revolves around 4 characters. The main character is Chasen Stedman, who's a young, over-the-hill TV star who kind of wanders the city. He's famous for essentially being famous. He befriends a critic named Perkis Tooth. These names, Tooth and Stedman, are, of course, not even remotely related to real names, same as Richard Abneg, another major character in the book. Why did you choose names that kind of stood out in an almost Pynchon-esque way?
growing up as a reader, I always loved character names that I could really remember and that were strange and vivid and that would stick in my head. Because even with novels I liked a lot, I often had trouble remembering the characters' names if they were ordinary. And so I was always grateful to Pynchon or Dickens, who I think of as the gold standard for peculiar and evocative character names. And I sort of promised myself I would reciprocate this when I was bestowing my characters' names. This book, I think they are a degree more absurd, or anyway, they're more absurd than they've been in a while. The character names in my earliest books were quite strange. It's a way of pointing an arrow, I hope not too much of a, neon or flaming arrow, to the possible allegorical or symbolic properties of the book itself. That these are characters, but they're also actors in some sort of strange symbolic realm. And this doubleness that I felt about the city and the lives being lived in the city is something I was trying to get on the page, that everything is unreal and real at the same time.
Well, when you call it an allegorical realm, how conscious is the allegory, and how much of it is just bubbling up from your unconscious so that afterwards you could say, aha, allegory?
I've just offered that term, and it's one I'm sheepish about, because allegory suggests a very definite interpretation. This equals this, and if you have the master key, you'll see what all the equivalences are. I don't really feel that that's true of this book or of my work ever, but what I like is the flavor of allegory. You might call it opaque allegory, where things are resonant, they're charged with potential interpretations, but they can't be easily resolved or clearly resolved into symbols. They simply nag at you with the force of a symbol, so that you're drawn into a reading experience, if this doesn't sound too pompous, where you're enjoying it, you're responding to it on one very homely, ordinary, human level, but you also feel this possible presence of large forces or a kind of a dream life behind the screen.
When creating a name like Chase Instedman or Una Laszlo, I mean, in the case of Laszlo, we're reminded of Casablanca, in the case of Chase Instedman, Instedman.
He's like a superhero of distraction, Instedman.
Right.
He gives you something to think about instead of the distant catastrophes that should be occupying your attention.
And he's also chasing around, of course, not really for anything.
Yeah. But then again, Richard, I find myself defending these names from time to time, and then I think, wait a minute, we've underestimated how weird real names are. I think very few people have very, very ordinary names. I find myself meeting people with names so strange that if I used them in stories, we'd be having this same conversation all the time. Sometimes you just consider the names you take for granted. I was something about driving into San Francisco from the airport yesterday. I was thinking about the Jefferson Airplane, having gotten off an airplane. I thought, so the lead singer of the sort of, glamorous, decadent, hippie chick from the 60s was really Grace Slick? How good is that? How strange is that? If I'd made that up, you'd be asking me about that, too.
The character of Perkis Tooth, and a lot of the book revolves around this character, he is a critic. I read one review which brought up the name Delmore Schwartz, and another review which brought up a different name, a guy named Paul Nelson, someone you knew. Who is or was Paul Nelson?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. Well, he was a terrifically important early music writer in that generation that includes Robert Christgau, Lester Bangs, Greil Marcus, Dave Marsh, and a few others who essentially invented the vocabulary. At a time when no one thought this stuff was anything but ephemeral pop music, they created the idea that you could talk about it seriously as art. It was kind of a heroic act of criticism by fiat in the 60s on the part of these guys. And Paul was one of the first. He wrote about folk music in basically a zine. It would probably be a blog if it were started today, called the Little Sandy Review, based in Minneapolis. And he also had the strange fate of being a teenage friend of Bob Dylan's. And Paul's actually in the Martin Scorsese No Direction Home documentary, giving very, very amusing testimony about a time when Bob Dylan basically came over to his house and cleaned out his record collection. Just, so fascinated with the great folk music that Paul and his roommate had assembled that Dylan decided he needed to have it for himself. And Paul came to New York in the same era when folk music was exploding in New York, and his first fame in some ways came as Dylan's crucial defender when Dylan went electric. So just as Dylan was excommunicated from the folk community, Paul sort of found himself excommunicated as the writer who thought it was worth doing. And went on to become an A&R guy and signed the New York Dolls to their first recording contract. Not as famous or as flamboyant as some of the other rock writers, but really seminal figure, and all his peers think of him as sort of, you know, their secret champion. He's somebody I got to know when I was in my early 20s. I was just in the process of dropping out of college and declaring myself a writer in the period just before I came to the Bay Area. When I was thinking of staying on the East Coast, in fact, I came very close to getting an apartment with Paul in Queens before I flipped the other way and decided I need to, you know, run to the West Coast. And in that time, Paul opened a door to his obsessions. He let me see how important all sorts of lost culture was. Orson Welles movies, you know, rare Howard Hawks movies. He was into Ross McDonald. He was into Chet Baker. And for me, it was like a crash course in pop culture obsession. Now, Paul doesn't really resemble Perkis Tooth in that many outward ways. He was never a pothead, and he wasn't a kind of a manic character. He was very mellow, actually, soft-spoken, kind of dry. But the relationship of sitting at the foot of this guy who knew so much, drew so many fascinating, arcane connections inside the culture, and just soaking it all up, that relationship deeply influenced the narrator's relationship to this character, Perkis Tooth.
Had you always been thinking about using elements of him in a book?
Well, I think that crept up on me. And, you know, there are other sources for this character, too. I guess I've always been drawn to the image of the sort of outsider critic, different species than the outsider artist and less celebrated. But, you know, people like Seymour Krim or Leslie Fiedler, who sort of work in this wildcat relationship to the culture and sometimes find a shelter in some academic environment, but more often they, you know, kind of go quietly crazy. Another one that I really care a lot about is a guy named George Trow, who wrote an incredible book called In the Context of No Context. So he's in there, too, in this idea about Perkis Tooth. At another level, putting pop culture and criticism aside, Tooth is an idea about having, you know, a friend who's impossible. Any character I've ever known who was sort of the person you wanted to take care of, but it was impossible to take care of them, who was obnoxious but so compelling that you couldn't quit hanging around with them, who was going crazy in a way that kind of drove you crazy, too, but also turned you on.
Jonathan Lethem, there's a lot of marijuana smoked in Chronic City, so much so that a cursory reading, which is, I think, what Michiku Kikutani did for the New York Times, almost makes it feel as if this is a pot book and that everyone's stoned, but in fact, they're not. Or if they are, it doesn't really matter. It's virtual Manhattan. Why so much marijuana?
I suppose I was trying to get at this feeling that accompanies that drug of kind of the fast cycle between revelation and a crash. You know, I find the cycle very poignant and very human. In a way, the marijuana functions in this book as a mode of critical inquiry. It's a theory. It's a way of looking at the world. It's like trying on, you know, Marxism or existentialism or Freudianism and saying, oh, look, the world is a veil of illusion. I'm going to tear it aside and show you the reality underneath. Now, these modes of inquiry are very tempting. They're very seductive. They also tend to collapse. They're not useful. At the end of the day, you have to live in the real world. You can't tear the veil off reality. But it takes a while. Well, in marijuana, the whole process is condensed to a 2 or 3 hour sequence. You have a moment where you think you've stripped the illusions away and you can see the true face of reality. And then within, you know, another hour, you're feeling irritable and hungry and you have a hamburger and then you sleep for 10 hours. And in the morning, you have to take a shower and start your regular life again. So it seemed very emblematic for me of the idea that we're always looking for these deep interrogations of what we suspect is wrong with the world, but we're also condemned to live in the world as it is.
It also allows you to go off on riffs that you probably couldn't get away with if they weren't stoned.
I guess it was also a chance to send these guys careening through their world in a very amusing way. Anyway, it amused me. One of the things I wanted to capture in this book, and it really has nothing to do with marijuana any more than it has to do with, you know, cups of coffee, which they're also frantically consuming through the book, it's the nature of hanging out with people whose brains are on fire, who are thinking faster than they can talk, and what it feels like to get into that relationship and cherish it, but also feel its, well, like I say, its uselessness to the life you're trying to live.
It also seemed that by putting that haze around those characters, you're also, in a way, creating an arc novel because they're alone in this world, or even a road novel, they're alone in this world traveling together, and their consciousness is sufficiently different from the consciousnesses of most of the folks around them.
I like that description a lot. And yeah, I mean, it is. It's a book about the diminishing possibilities of dissident attitudes in a place as defined by money and power as present-day Manhattan is. It's a book that raises the question of, can you be a dissident against such a powerful force as what Manhattan represents?
Well, here we are in 2009, and we're beginning to see 9/11 novels. This is clearly not a 9/11 novel. It's almost a post and slash pre-9/11 novel, where that particular event which transformed the city becomes kind of a bubble that's disappearing into the atmosphere.
Yeah, I think I never could have gone at that subject directly. You know, I think it would overwhelm the fiction. At the same time, I think I was going after the emotional essence of that experience in this book indirectly in a lot of different ways. And, I mean, all that air of catastrophe and dread that hangs over the city in Chronic City is directly traceable in my mind to the feelings that I went through, that we collectively went through being there at that time. But it's also a lot to do with 2004. And that was the point of origin for this book. That's when I began to sketch it out. When we reelected George Bush, and the meaning of the trauma that we'd experienced 3 years earlier was, in a sense, taken away from New Yorkers. You know, what had been an extremely intimate, tragic, and real experience had been turned definitively, once he was reelected, into a symbol that didn't belong to the city and had nothing to do with what we went through then, but was instead a kind of banner for waving to excuse a much larger crime, really a global catastrophe. And so a lot of New Yorkers, I think, I certainly felt this way, kind of fell into a morose silence on the subject of 9/11, because to speak of it was somehow to be complicit with the use it had been put to.
You mentioned before that you began in 2004, which is after, I guess, completing You Don't Love Me Yet, which takes place in Los Angeles, another semi-fictional city. What were the specific origins of the book? What brought you to decide to write about basically the Upper East Side and these characters roaming through it?
This book, I think, has been arriving, you know, on the horizon of my consciousness for a long time. I've always had a tortured kind of love hate affair with Manhattan as a Brooklynite. I set some of that up for you to begin with. And it's not that Manhattan never appears in my work. There are scenes, in important ones, in Fortress of Solitude and Motherless Brooklyn, where the characters, you know, get to Manhattan and are mostly sort of defeated there. But I do think this is really, for me, a 21st century glimpse of the city. It has to do with the hangover of that millennial nightmare of 9/11, and with the apprehension of the coming crash, which is in some ways, a very Manhattan site-specific disaster that the city has now imposed on the rest of us, on the whole world, because it's the place where the nonsensical financial virtual reality of debt was conceived and inflated until it destroyed itself. I don't claim any really special predictive powers. I think a lot of people could feel the prodrome of that nightmare coming, and so this book was written out of that feeling, too.
Was the key element starting the book Chase and Stedman or Perkis Tooth?
Perkis Tooth was a character in search of a framework for a while, and then Chase came in a hurry when the whole book began to announce itself to me, the idea of putting Perkis into, you know, making him the kind of disenfranchised bohemian on the Upper East Side and thinking about the milieu that he'd be moving through up there. Chase became part of that image.
In my mind, the second half of the book, which may have been written maybe after or during the period of the crash, was constant reference back to Mick Jagger's song Shattered.
Right. That song is a very talismanic song of my New York City, the New York City I knew in the late 70s. But there's something also really decrepit or corrupt about that song. It's the Rolling Stones sort of trying to do punk rock, and they're too old to do it. So in a way, they're very much like Perkis Tooth in a funny way. They're like clinging to their bohemian symbol even after they've become, you know, eclipsed by money and fame, and they're no longer a legitimate dissident voice, I think, at that point. But somehow it's an anthem anyway.
Jonathan Lethem, there's a subplot involving a woman in outer space, the wife of Chasen Stedman. And I'm just curious whether the resolution of that story was there from the beginning.
Yes. I knew for certain that I wanted, as painful as it was to realize this, that I wanted her to be taken away from Chase at the end of the book. And the model for that was very, very specific. It was Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, the sort of ultimate love triangle where the third leg of the triangle is imaginary, a woman who never existed. And that's a story that's always haunted me, and I've always looked for a way I could rework it in my own writing.
Through most of the book, there's a big blank, which is what Chase's relationship is with this woman in space. I'm still confused at the ending where we're not sure about what his memory is. Does he know what's been going on all along, or does he not know?
Well, I'm very glad you asked this, because I think it's the most elusive thing about the book, and I think people hesitate to ask. I worked very hard in understanding myself what I meant. In my mind, Chase is, in effect, a player in a reality show. And just as backstage in the green room at the Jerry Springer show, you may remember that some of what you're going to be presenting once the light blinks and you're on stage and it's time to begin throwing chairs and screaming at your spouse or your in-laws or whomever you're meant to treat as a kind of villain, that some of that may be false. By the time you step out onto that stage and inhabit the role and begin playing it out, you've forgotten. The way you find the emotion, the way you find the persuasiveness to play the part is you believe it. And Chase is an actor who's forgotten he's in a script. And that's what I think Perkis is there to tell him and trying so hard to make him understand, is that he's not just a witness to the city's illusions, he's one of the propagators of illusion.
Most of the book takes place in the point of view, first-person point of view, of Chasen Stedman. In fact, at one point he does mention he's typing this out, so we know it's not merely the, you know, the narrator we get in a lot of books, like any mystery book, just telling the story, and you're going, who's he telling it to? Is he writing it down? Because we know he's writing it down. There are also segments that appear to be third-person point of view from the point of view of Perkis Tooth. At the beginning, maybe a third to halfway through the book, there aren't that many. In your mind, are those actual third person, or is that also Chasen Stedman writing about Perkis Tooth in the third person?
Well, I think if you analyze it, because they bleed back into the first person accounts, you have to ascribe them to Chase's writing, in a sense. He's become a writer. In some way, I'm making use of the kind of privileges that, say, Philip Roth assigns to Zuckerman, where he knows more than he could possibly know about characters that he's telling you about. He enters into their consciousness the way a writer does. You know, Chase is a method actor, so he's feeling his way into these lives when he needs to understand something that he hasn't from his own perspective. But in my mind, there could be one deeper layer of unveiling it at the end of the book, which is you could also imagine that Una Laszlo wrote the whole thing.
Because she's a ghostwriter.
Right. It's just there to think about if you want to think about it. It's not necessary. I thought about teasing the reader with that possibility, and then I thought, I'll just tease myself with that possibility.
Well, it answers one of my biggest questions and problems with the book, which is that here we have this child actor who's writing like a writer.
Right. This is an objection that I think editors and people who are going to be in a position of, you know, a critic, or in your case, a reader who's going to have to discuss the book, tend to register. Readers, I think, tend to allow narrators to be as brilliant as they like. And for me, I derive this authority in my mind, I could be mistaken, from Dickens, who makes orphan children as eloquent as the greatest writer who ever lived.
In Motherless Brooklyn, you were very specific about creating a voice.
Right.
I mean, in that case, you knew what you were doing. You were not going to create a voice that has those kinds of powers.
Right. Well, I do think that there's a bifurcation, actually, in Motherless Brooklyn between the kinds of things Lionel Essrog tends to say aloud and the kinds of things he's able to say on the page. He's still a preternaturally capable writer if you look at the book on that level.
Jonathan Lethem, in 2007 you wrote an essay in Harper's about appropriation of other materials, started something which you call the Promiscuous Materials Project, which is kind of, I guess, part of and analogous to the idea of sampling in music. What role do you think it plays in Chronic City?
You know, there are a couple of gestures in that direction, because those gestures have become important to me. I suppose I might even confess that they're sentimentally important to me. The fact is, despite my very extensive interest in and advocacy of intertextuality in the arts generally, in the visual arts, in music, in T.S. Eliot's poetry or Shakespeare's plays, a novelist working with traditional forms, which is what I do, with a traditional commitment to character and story, to narrative, has very few opportunities to be much of an appropriation artist. Just by the sort of technical facts of what you do when you're putting together a novel, it's not a form like, say, a sampled song or a piece of pop art by Robert Rauschenberg or something. It's not a form that lends itself very naturally to appropriation. So there are a couple of shout-outs, you might call them. There's one to Saul Bellow that I mention in the author's note at the end of the book. And for people who are music fans, you'll see here and there there's a tiny bit of song lyric that I might have glommed onto and woven into the book. But I would be misleading if I claimed that they were somehow essential to the book's composition. They're decorations.
The essay itself and the material on your website about promiscuous materials rubs me in a whole bunch of different ways. One, of course, is the entire copyright issue, which has, as you say, been kind of expropriated by distributors rather than by the initial artists. And it affects radio because a number of programs can no longer be aired, be put online, because of seconds of music that are owned by distributors, not by the original artists. In fact, the original artists frequently don't get a penny.
Of course. This happens all the time. Yeah. Well, that essay was meant as a provocation, so my extensive defense of plagiarism often rubs a lot of people a lot of ways. I feel very clear that the conversation around, you know, these matters, influence, copyright, appropriation, intertextuality, is one that needs to be taken away from the lawyers and given back to the artists. It doesn't mean that I have some absolute conclusions that I would lead everyone to, but I think that initial conclusion I'm confident of.
Well, from an artistic standpoint, I could see where, you know, you take multiple objects and in a way create a new object without losing sight of the original object, which is what we're talking about here. On the other hand, you wind up with, entertaining as it is, a postmodern dead end like Inglourious Basterds.
Well, every work of art created by whatever means or under whatever banner is going to finally be judged by its persuasiveness, whether it excites you, whether it compels you, whether it has its own absolutely clear reason for being. You know, and I think it's always a case-by-case evaluation. That applies whether postmodern methods are used or not. You know, I often shift the conversation to musical matters. You know, judging these gestures of appropriating something that doesn't seem to belong to you is always going to be an intuitive, response-based evaluation. When you think about, you know, let's say Paul Simon's Graceland, you know, so what do you think of that? Well, let's see. It's really African music with Paul Simon's voice laid over the top of it, which can make you feel uncomfortable. But on the other hand, he never hid what he was doing. In fact, he brought the musicians with him and put them on stage and took them around the world on a tour. So on the level of transformation, it might be relatively thin, but on the level of transparency, it was marvelously open. Then you have Led Zeppelin, who steal Willie Dixon's songs and make a radically new musical form out of them. They invent heavy metal, and no one who's ever heard the source material in Willie Dixon would ever imagine that, you know, it doesn't sound like Led Zeppelin. They created something completely new, but on the other hand, they were contemptuous of their sources. They cheated Willie Dixon of his royalties and were only forced at legal gunpoint to acknowledge the connection. So on the level of transformation, high marks. On the level of transparency, very low ones.
Jonathan Lethem, you're doing a marathon reading of the entire novel of Chronic City. What's the story behind that, and do you prepare at all?
This goes back to You Don't Love Me Yet, which was the first of my books that I'd been ever asked to be the audio book performer for. Unlike my previous novels, I had this strange experience of going into a recording studio and sitting there for 2 days and reading the book from beginning to end. Now, this happened to be done when the book was in galleys and about to be published, so it was too late for me to make editorial changes. But it was a very revealing process. And there were a lot of things I loved that were revealed, and there were a couple of flat spots that I wished I'd had a chance to go back to. So it made me vow to myself that I would read my next book aloud to someone. I'd find someone to put it across to in this manner while I was still able to work on it. And so last winter, when Chronic City was in its final stages, I gathered a group of people around me, actually in rural Maine, snowbound early January in rural Maine, where I had a great captive audience, people who had very little else to do. And we sat in the local public library, and, you know, it was a floating group of between 7 or 8 and sometimes 20 or 25 people, and they listened to me read the whole book over a course of 8 nights. And it was incredibly useful as an editorial device. It's one reason that I feel such a pride and confidence in this book, because I feel like I gave it this extra layer of scrutiny, trying to put it across aloud. What surprised me was it was a very intimate transaction. The feeling in the room was exciting to me. So then I thought, maybe when the book's published, I'll do this again. I'll read it to people from beginning to end, because after all, that's how a book functions. And it would be a way to defeat the mechanical quality that public readings sometimes take on, where you just have one chapter and you rehearse it and you just deliver it like it's a, you know, an advertisement over and over again.
Jonathan Lethem, Motherless Brooklyn and Fortress of Solitude, either of them close enough to being filmed or not?
I don't think right now those two are the lead horses, actually. I'd love to be proven wrong, but I don't think they're on the verge of being filmed. I'm not always keeping the closest tabs on them. But right now, strangely enough, Gun With Occasional Music has a very strong producer and a director attached, and I think if I were to bet, I would bet that the first film we'd see would be that one.
What's the story of Tonight at Noon?
Tonight at Noon is a mysterious project. I'm still rooting for it. I've become very good friends with a director who's incredibly talented, and his process as a filmmaker is a little bit like Orson Welles. He has a lot of half-finished films that he's tinkering with all the time, and he keeps telling me that he's only a few reshoots away from having the material he needs to finish Tonight at Noon, and I'm fascinated. I've never seen any of the stuff he has shot, but in the process, you know, we became friends, and actually I'm a great fan of some of the films he's made subsequently. So Michael Almereyda is the filmmaker. He has a lot of actors who he calls in and has them work for him briefly, and he's a filmmaker who works more like a painter. I think that's the best way to describe it.
Jonathan Lethem, I met you in the mid-80s. You'd come to San Francisco Bay Area and became involved in the science fiction world. Gun With Occasional Music is a science fiction novel. Looking back on it now, after writing books like Fortress of Solitude, Motherless Brooklyn, Chronic City, where do you see your early life within the science fiction community emanating outward in these essentially mainstream novels?
Well, they're published very emphatically as mainstream novels, but Fortress of Solitude is pegged on a magic ring. There almost couldn't be a more grotesquely obvious fantasy element if you tried. It's straight out of Wagner or Tolkien or a box of Cheerios. It's not that the writing is one thing or the other. It tends to be true that the career moves in one direction or the other because of the emphasis my publisher puts on things. And frankly, I enjoy the fluidity that comes with shaking off the trappings of genre publication. But Chronic City, I think anyone who was interested in my earliest work, I mean, frankly, the book this most resembles at its core, in my mind, is Amnesia Moon. It's a book of reality fragmenting, and in that sense, it's deeply indebted to Philip K. Dick. In fact, part of the reason Chronic City exists is because I did the editorial job of gathering Philip K. Dick's work for the Library of America, which meant I was rereading all these books that had been so influential, so persuasive for me when I was younger, but I hadn't actually reread them in a long time. And suddenly I thought, I can make something out of this Dickian reality effect with my new inclinations and my new capacities as a writer. I can meld this into the New York material, and it'll be something very exciting to me. So you could just as easily publish Chronic City as a kind of ontological horror novel or a science fiction novel of the sort that, you know, J.G. Ballard and Philip K. Dick wrote. I think it has a close relationship to that stuff. The difference you describe is more of an outward one. It more has to do with publishing histories and critical and readerly reception than it does with anything about my operation as a writer. Really, somewhere in the early 70s, by the time, you know, Don DeLillo's written Ratner's Star and Bartholomew's written his fantasies and Robert Coover's written his and Gravity's Rainbow appears, the methods that define science fiction as a separate set of operations, literary operations, as opposed to just a subculture, a gathering place for like-minded people, had dissolved into the mainstream of literary culture. That didn't mean that science fiction had become accepted by mainstream culture, but it did mean that the methods were available to writers, and I've always chosen to act as though that were permanently the case.
You could also add Kurt Vonnegut to that
list. Kurt Vonnegut, of course, yeah.
Jonathan Lethem, now this has been published and finished a while ago. Are you working on another novel?
I've just barely got a little something going. I've got research and a first chapter of a book I'm excited to write, but it barely exists, so I daren't speak of it.
Is it a New York novel?
It is in New York again, but quite different from Chronic City and maybe closer in some ways to the Fortress of Solitude in its historical leaning. It's going to be set in the late 50s and early 60s in Greenwich Village and Queens, actually.
You've been listening to an interview with Jonathan Lethem, whose latest novel is Chronic City. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.